Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Tom Flynn, alcoholic. I'm sober through the grace of God and people just like you and good sponsorship, and that's what I'm supposed to talk about, sponsorship. Generally, when Clancy comes, he can talk about anything he wants, but he always gives me an assigned subject. I'm still slowly earning their trust and their direction. I came to you guys and I stayed. I was here 4 months. I didn't know you could leave. That's how sick I was. I thought you had to go to New York and get like a release or something from the president of AA. And then I found out we didn't have a president. And then I really had a dilemma. And then I got a sponsor. Well, I didn't get a sponsor. The sponsor got me. And he said he needed someone to work with. And I thought, like one of them laboratory mice or something. You know, an experiment. I thought, what's this? He needs somebody to work with, you know. And he says, we are going to do the steps. I said, fine. I didn't know what the steps were, but fine seemed like a good answer. And I didn't want what my sponsor had. I didn't know what he had. I see these guys running around hugging each other, and I wasn't sure where I was. I mean, off in South Baltimore, you know. That's where they load ships, you know, and they built airplanes and stuff like that. There were very few piano lesson teachers in my area. There were some boxing clubs and things of that nature, but that's how it was. And so I got this. The sponsor got me. He says, we are going to do the steps. You know, and he was direct. Before I start, I'll finish right on time. I like that. But I spent 4 years in a Roman Catholic seminary. I very seldom tell this. Studying to be a priest. And obviously, I didn't become a priest. And they were able to cancel the expansion plans for hell. Saved them some money there. And some years later, I found this God I was pursuing since I was 8 years old in a church basement. I thought I would find God in the sanctuary, and I wanted to get a good seat. So you'd be a priest, you'd be up front, you know what I mean? And I thought I had a theology problem. I didn't become, well, I didn't. I had a geography problem. I was on the wrong floor. That was the problem. God was in that church. He's in all churches and everywhere, see? I just wasn't aware of it. You know, I was looking for him in the sanctuary. He's in you and he's in me, he's in your hearts. And I get all of this from sponsorship and alcoholics. Some of the teachers I had in the seminary, they were Sulpician priests. They were specially trained to train young hardheads like me. And they were good. But I just wasn't ready. Now I got the sponsor. He's a retired, unemployed truck driver. And he talked about God like he had lunch with him. I said, how can you talk about God like that, you know, that these and nows and all that stuff? And he just said, well, he's my father. Got a lot of nerve. So he told me, we're going to do the steps. He says, Tom, when you drink, do you know when you're going to stop? And I says, no. He says, it looks like you're powerless when you start.
Well, if you want to put it that way, Wally.
He says, I want to put it that way. I'm the sponsor. And I said the most spiritual words I've ever said in my life.
Okay, Wally.
That's what surrender is. Ain't got nothing to do with Pearl Harbor.
Okay, Wally.
Get in the car, Tom.
Okay, Wally.
He says, when you stop, do you know when you're going to start?
Oh, no, Wally.
He says, well, it looks like to me that when you started, you're perilous. And when you stopped and you start again, you're perilous. See? He says, starting and stopping are intermittent. What's consistent is powerlessness.
Okay, Wally.
How do you select a sponsor? I think it's quite simple. You go to some meetings and you watch people. You find a man or a woman who has what you want. It's only three things. You find a person who has what you want. You do what they do. And you will get what they have. And that's what you wanted. Say that again, Wally. We must take the action. It's not necessary to believe in the action. It's not necessary to understand the action. It is necessary to take the action. The belief and understanding will follow in varying degrees. Okay. He says, do you believe there's a power that's done something for me? I didn't know. I just met him. But I said, yes, seemed to be appropriate. You know, you did the same thing, didn't you? Yeah, I thought you would. Yeah. So I said, yes.
I can't do the third step, Wally. Why is that, Tom? I says, I hate to tell you this, Wally, but I don't believe in God.
He says, say the prayer anyway. He broke out laughing. He says, God don't care what you believe. He says, the only God cares what you believe is you. And you're sitting on the floor of an unemployed truck driver about to say a prayer to a God you don't believe. Somehow he had the ability to cut through things for me. I had to tell him I was a Hopkins man. He says, give me your diploma. I said, what are you going to do with that? He says, in case of flood, stand on it. My sponsor has never been impressed by me. You know, he's got me to the point now, I look in the mirror in the morning, and I'm no longer impressed by me either. So what a relief. What a great relief. Look at all the time I wasted in my life trying to impress you. And I'm not even impressed with me. It's just that simple. You know, I'm impressed with the world. I'm impressed by a lot of things, you know. I'm impressed by the clouds and the trees and the laughter of children, all that stuff, just like you are. But I'm not impressed with me. That's all. I am grateful with me that I don't have to drink today. And I'm grateful. I'm glad about it. You know, I'm walking around AA and I was serious. I'm smart, you know. I told you that, didn't I? Yeah, okay. I'm smart and I'm walking around serious. You know, one old timer says, Tom, you know, are you glad to be sober? Oh, yeah, Dudley, I'm glad to be sorry. He said, why don't you tell your face about it? This is a new guy would have to be a mind reader to find out that you're glad to be sober. I got all kinds of stuff I don't know how to use. So I guess I'll just leave it alone. That's the best thing to do with that.
I can't wait no four-step, Wally, because I've got to tell it to you, and you love to throw me out. You can't.
Yeah. He says, have you done anything that ain't in a dictionary?
No, Wally, I've been a little creative, but not that creative.
He says, well, then if it's all in a dictionary, it's so common what you have done, we have to have an agreed meeting about it. It's common. Eh? So, whoa, is that common? The only thing I had left when I came to you people, I thought I was at least a serious sinner. Everything else I failed. I failed at my business. I failed at the marriage. You know, I was divorced and was living under a bridge. I let these guys come to me. He said to me,
Oh, the air conditioning in my halfway house is broke.
Oh. Get him some Kleenex. Or at least a fan. Poor soul. Hey, it was a major thing to wake up with your shoes. In jail, cigarettes are... But under bridge dwelling, shoes is a negotiable instrument. At least in the border, mid-Atlantic states it is. In West Coast, it might be... Just, you have to quiz Clancy about that. He has a lot of clients and friends who have experienced the shoeless adventure. I'm sure that he could explain it to you. I tried to look, I got 2 minutes. I tried to look busy. I really could tell you why I know in a minute and a half, really. I tried to look busy to impress my sponsor. And he says, I see you running around here, and you know, what are you doing? And I heard some smart guy say he was working on his character defects. And boy, that sounded industrious. Now, finally, I'm going to impress my sponsor. So he looks at me, he says, what are you doing? I says, I'm working on my character defects. I was got one of them sweatbands to improve, you know, I was really working. One of you young guys talked to me after the meeting, because most of the sweatbands, what's that all about? Most of the guys I know that were in sweatbands are unemployed. What the hell's that about? They ain't working. What do they need a sweatband for? I don't get it. But I'm sure you can explain it to me. You know? I have an open mind about it. See? But I was working on my character defects. You know? And he said, what step do you use? And I said, 6. He said, what's it say? Now, my sponsor wears a hearing aid, and I talk too long, he shuts it off. I mean, we're sensitive people. We notice those things, you know. And he's got it on, and he says, what's it say? I said, entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character. You're working on your character? Yeah. What's it say? It's entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character. He said, who? I says, God. He said, well, what do you got your fingers in there for? Don't you know a sick mind? Can I fix a sick mind? You can't do a darn thing about your character defects except ask God to remove them. How you let God know? Just stand there with your hands open. Okay, you can do that. That's all I got time for. And we honor each other's time because we respect one another. And now for a man who has moved both my mind and my feet and my heart, I give you Clancy from the Southern Pacific.
My name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm very glad to be here tonight, glad to be back. This is my 7th trip to this group. It's only your 6th anniversary, isn't it? I was here at their first meeting as well. That makes the 7th. But I'm very glad to be here, and I was glad to feel the throb of enthusiasm here and to come and see how you are being persecuted by the do-nothing groups around you. I don't want to talk overtime, but I will. Anyway, I was coming up on the I was coming up on the plane today from Jacksonville, Florida, and I was reading the Jacksonville, Florida Tribune, and they had an article on, of all things, the efforts people have made in the military over the years to curb the sexual drives of the military folks. Because you get off in a group with a whole bunch of guys, you know, you'd want to be always worried about who's going to come at you. And I was thinking, when I was a boy, 15 years old, I ran away from home early in the Second World War, and I ran, hitchhiked to San Francisco, and I got just a dumb little kid. I got on a ship, and I'm in the Merchant Marine. And later on, when I got old enough, I went in the Navy. And they said that in World War II, all the ships, they fed the people saltpeter, which I don't know if you know what that's for, but that's to curb the sexual drive in males. And I must have eaten pounds of that stuff. And it never seemed to have any effect on me at all. I was always thinking about girls and... And I'll tell you the damnedest thing about that saltpeter. It just kicked in about 5 years ago. I've tried to overcome it. I had a little bad luck on that, too. A few years ago, when I turned 70, my doctor started giving me iron tablets for my blood. And I've taken a lot of iron tablets in the last 10 years. And just recently, I've been reading advertising and trying to go back to my memories. So I was going to try to overcome my problems. And I tried my first Viagra. And I didn't realize this, but if you're taking iron tablets, you're not supposed to take Viagra. And now every 6 hours, I face north. Anyway, that's all the news I have from the front for tonight. One other thing I want to tell you. I was telling my friends this earlier tonight that last week I was on the coming back from Long Beach. I talked at a meeting in Long Beach coming back to West Los Angeles on the 405 freeway, which is a big major freeway through West Los Angeles. And I was driving, and my wife called me and said, "You better be careful. There was just a thing on the television about there's a wrong-way driver on the 405. So you be careful." And I said, "There's mistaken. There's 200 of them." Enough of that. I know we have some new people here tonight. You're probably wondering what all this is about. What's a big deal here? An anniversary of a group and... people are sober, so what, and on and on. And it's hard to realize that this is a very unusual turn of events, because as long as there's been written records of mankind, there have been written records of people who abuse alcohol, some small group within the body politic. And at one time they thought they were possessed by devils. They put them to death. They flogged them and beat them and send them away and deport them. And even when I was... at least for 4,000 years, there's a record of this particular little group of people who abuse alcohol and don't seem to care about anything. And even when I was a little boy, there still was no answer to it anywhere in the world. One of the stories of Alcoholics Anonymous is one of the guys that got it all the ball rolling, a man named Roland Hazard, was sent to... They didn't know much about alcoholism. In 1930, he was... He was from a wealthy family in New York, and they were grooming him to take over the company, and he was in his mid-30s. And so, but he had a terrible malady. When he got terribly nervous, it seemed like he would drink to excess, and they couldn't imagine why. So what anybody reasonable would do, they found the best psychiatrist in the world and sent him there to get cured of his nervousness. They called Dr. Freud, or wrote Dr. Freud. And Dr. Freud refused to take the case. That's the first break we ever got. We'd all be sitting here drunk tonight and saying, "But I dreamt I was sober." So they got his colleague, Dr. Jung, and they got a hold of Dr. Jung. The doctor said, "Yes, bring him." So two guys brought this nice guy, a very pleasant, nice man, to... Switzerland, to Dr. Jung's hospital, and he worked with him for a year to break through the defenses and break through those emotional patterns and the neurosis that's causing this nervousness, which caused in turn him to drink. And at the end of the year, he felt that he had shown him the way. He had shown him the way. Now you know, Roland, you've got to, you understand yourself now, you understand the problem, you can go home and live a normal life. And he went back, and he stopped in Paris with some wealthy friends of his family, and they had a big dinner for him, and they toasted his success. And a couple of days later, he was face down in his own vomit again, and nobody could understand why. But you weren't nervous. Why did you drink like this? So they took him back to Dr. Jung. And Dr. Jung refused to take him back. They said, why? He's not a bad man, doctor. He just got attacking nerves. He said, no, I understand that. I realize that I've misdiagnosed his case, he said. I thought he had deep psychological problems that I could help him with. But I now realize that he is what is known as a chronic alcoholic. And to the best of my knowledge, there is no effective treatment for that condition in the world today at any price. That was 1931. That wasn't all that long ago. And Roland, of course, was kind of taken aback. He says, what does this mean, doctor? He says, it means that you must keep yourself confined voluntarily or involuntarily as long as you live. Otherwise, you almost certainly will intermittently drink to excess until you die or go mad. Bad news. He says, is there no other way? He said, I've in some of our literature, I've read cases where there are people who've had this problem who have had some sort of involuntary psychological reaction. They call it some sort of a spiritual experience, but I've never seen one, and I've never known anyone personally that had one. He says, I suggest to you that your chances of having an involuntary spiritual experience are less than your chances of being hit by lightning. So Roland came back, felt pretty bad, and he didn't stop in Paris at all this time. And he got in a ship, and on the way home, he did something, apparently, that people like us have to do, although we don't know it. He felt so bad that he somehow surrendered to the fact that he was hopeless and helpless. And he came back, and he thought, what can I do? And there was a thing then called the Oxford Movement, which was kind of a groups of very nice people would get together and discuss spiritual values in one another's homes. And Roland had been a vestryman in the Presbyterian Church. And so he'd been a religious man, but it hadn't helped him. So he went to this Oxford group to see if they could help him. And he stayed sober. And his family, of course, ascribed it to the Oxford group, but that isn't true because the Oxford group had a lot of people in who drank and couldn't stop drinking. Probably was more likely because he had done that surrender on the ship. But it just started two or three little funny coincidences I want to talk about tonight, which makes us so real how lucky we are to be here. He stayed sober, and his family so proud and so happy, and he active in the Oxford group and helping people and doing things. And they said, Roland, you're surpassing our wishes. We're so proud. Why don't you take a vacation? You haven't had a vacation since you went to Europe. We have a home up in Vermont where we spend our summers. Go up there and spend some time. So we just arbitrarily one week he went up to Vermont. And the interesting thing about that is if he'd have gone there the next week, we wouldn't be here. Just a funny series of little things. Just seconds and inches. He got there. Felt good. One of his friends came over and said, oh, our other friend that we used to run around together, Ebby, he's really in bad shape drinking. Could you talk to him, Roland? And I know that you're sober now. He says, well, I'll try. And they brought Ebby over, and Roland tried to tell him a little bit about the Oxford group. And he said, I don't want to hear that religious crap. You come on, Roland. I know what's happened to you, but I don't want to hear it. And the next week, while he was there, Ebby got really drunk and drove his car into somebody's house. And he was on severe probation. And they went to court. And this kid came over again and said, Roland, I hate to bother you, but would you come down to court and talk to the judge? He's my father, and he won't listen to me. But he'll listen to you because he knows your family. Go down there and see if you can help Ebby, because they're going to send Ebby to the state penitentiary. So he went down there and said, Judge, well, you know me, and I used to drink, and I got in the Oxford group, and I'm doing much better now. Could you possibly contemplate putting Ebby in my care? And I'll take him to New York. And the judge says, only because it's you, Roland, and I know your father. I wouldn't do this for anyone. I wouldn't do it for my own son. But you take him. But if he comes back to Vermont, he's going to the state penitentiary immediately. So I brought him back to New York and stuck him in a mission down on Lower Broadway and got him involved in the Oxford group. And at first he didn't like it. We got start feeling better. He stayed sober and he got active and I was doing pretty good. After about 6 months, Roland said, well, Ebby, it's time to take the next step. I said, what's that, Roland? He said, it's time to testify to someone. Testify what you found. And Ebby said, I don't want to testify to anybody. I don't know what I found, but I don't want to testify about it, I'll tell you that. That's embarrassing. Go up to people and say, oh, look what I found. And Roland said, you want to go back to Vermont? And he said, no, I don't think so. I believe I'll testify briefly. So he thought, how could I testify that embarrassing myself? And he happened to remember there was another friend of theirs who was in New York somewhere, who was a bigger mooch than he was, living off his wife, couldn't get a job, it'd been a big deal, and now was nothing. And he tried to find him. He finally found him, a guy named Bill Wilson over in Brooklyn. And he figured, I'll go over and testify to him. He won't even remember it next week. So, you know. So he made arrangements to go over and call on Bill. In our big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, in the first chapter, Bill's story, he talks about that. He talks about how he went to the door and here this Ebby, this old drunken friend, is now sharp and alert and kind. He said, what happened to you, Ebby? And Ebby says, I found religion. Oh, man. But I heard Ebby talk many, many years ago at a meeting and he at the 1960 International Convention. And that's the only talk he ever gave major that I ever heard of. And he went into a little more detail. Turned out that Bill did say that. And then they went and sat in the kitchen table and Ebby tried to tell him about the Oxford group. And all this time, Bill just sat there with a bottle of gin going, gee, that's really wonderful, Ebby. I'm so happy for you that you're simple. And he left, and he was very upset. He wasted his time coming to talk to this boob. So he came back 3 days later. It isn't in our literature, and I understand why, too. But he had the Oxford group closer with him. Mr. Wilson, I want to talk to you about the Oxford group, how we did. And Bill Wilson. And he responded by, I guess I'll go over to the mission and see Ebby. And on the way he got drunk. And they got to the mission, Ebby was gone, but he gave a short sermon to the folks anyway, just for the hell of it. And just a drunken mooch, and that night he was back in the hospital again. And the doctor there called his wife and said, Mrs. Wilson, I have some very bad news for you. I believe this is probably the last trip your husband will ever make here, because he's going to die. And we can't help him. We've worked with him again and again. And she was desperate. She said, well, he has this friend at the mission, Ebby Thatcher. Could you, let me see if I can get a hold of him. She called him up and said, will you go up to the town hospital and see Bill? They were very worried about him. So Ebby took a couple of guys up there. They sat and talked to him and said, you know, Bill, you've got to find someone to turn over your life to go to God. You've got to do that or else you can't. And Bill said, oh, come on. You know better than that. Just because you're goofy, I'm not goofy. That doesn't help. I just don't know. And in the middle of the night, Bill, in his desperation, that he didn't even mean it, he just cried out, God, if you're there, make yourself known. And then he wrote later, almost as though a light came on in this dark room. And he felt a wind blowing through. That can't be. The doors are all closed or open. And he thought, I'm certainly going insane. My brain is gone. And then all of a sudden went away. And he felt different. And the next doctor, he couldn't wait to tell the doctor in the morning, Doctor, did I go insane last night? Did I have a psychiatric breakthrough? I mean, it's just, what's wrong? Doctor said, I don't know what happened, Bill. But I suggest you hang on to it. Because you look different. And Bill came out of there a couple of days later. And he went to the Oxford group because he associated that. And he said, well, what's the big deal about Ebby and Roland and all these things happening to be there? Because the very few people ever had spiritual experiences of that sort always associated with religion, and they'd go into the church and go do church work. But he somehow accepted going to the Oxford group and trying to help people stop drinking. And he went to the Oxford group, and he got very involved. He would, trying to help people, he would pick up street drunks and bring them to the Oxford group meeting. And these were all very high, nice society people. I believe you're throwing up on my shoes, sir. And sometimes you'd take them home, and they'd never. And he'd do this week after week. Abby would go along with him sometimes and just say, give him hell, Bill. You know. And one morning, Bill got up in the morning where he lived over in Brooklyn, and he saw that the guy he brought home the night before, the last of a whole series of guys, had gotten up early, stolen some stuff out of the kitchen apparently to sell for wine, and left. And he turned to his wife, and he looked at her. She had been a society girl, very chic. Now she's just a little old lady, old before her time, with gray hair, putting on her cheap sweater with a patch on the sleeve to go to work at some cheap department store. This is what she had come to, trying to stay help with this guy. And he suddenly realized, what a mess I've made of my life, a mess I made of your life. He says, I thought that thing in the hospital gave me some sort of a reason to stop, help people stop drinking. He said, but I realize now I was wrong. I'm going to get a job somehow if it's just shoveling dirt. I'm not going to do that anymore. Lois, I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm going to be, not. I've tried for 6 months and not one person has stayed sober. And right then your life and mine hung by the thinnest thread you could imagine. And she turned to him and said something that changed the course of history. I was having lunch with her many years ago in Connecticut. And I said, how did you ever think of that answer, Lois? My God, it's just sensational. She said, I don't know. It just seemed so ordinary. I didn't know why you didn't understand it. He said, not one person has stayed sober with my efforts. And she said, you did. And you know, oh, yeah. That's why old timers don't have much hair in front. Just go through. And so he tried it again. And as most of us know the story in the book, I'm not going to go through the long history of AA, but he got a chance to. Somebody took notice he was sober. Just, here's your last chance, Bill. We're going to give you one more chance. You'd been a great stockbroker, but now you're a bum. We're going to give you one more chance. You understand you're sober. Go out to Akron. They're going to put this company together, and you're going to be president. And he went out to Akron, and the whole deal blew up. And he, on Saturday before Mother's Day, he stood in the lobby of a hotel out there, so discouraged, because he'd have to go back and admit failure again, and he'd never get another job, and he couldn't do anything. He had a $10 bill in his pocket. He could either pay his hotel bill or buy a train ticket home. And I'm kind of a romanticist. I remember some years ago I stood in that very spot in the lobby trying to imagine what it must have been like to feel that terrible despair and fear. And he wrote later, he realized that if he could have just a couple drinks, he'd think of an answer. Oh, over here was a little door with a little curved neon sign saying in an orange, cocktails. And he heard the sound of clinking glasses and laughter. And he started to go just one or two drinks, then alcohol. And right there again, this group and every group like it almost never was born. And out of the corner of his eye, he saw some telephones, payphones. And I don't know if you've ever been in little town hotels, but they usually have 8 or 9 ministers and their phone numbers, whatever, so you can go find where your church is. And he remembered he'd promised the people in New York he'd call somebody before he drank. And he said, well, I'll try it. He went over and called a minister. Said, hello, this is Reverend. He said, my name is Bill Wilson. I'm a rum hound from New York, and I'm really in bad shape. I've got to find somebody who's an alcoholic I can help. And the man said, I don't know what your problem is, sir, but I'm trying to write a sermon. Please don't bother me again. I'll tell you. So we called the next day. No answer. Next one, no answer. Now, I don't know about you, but if that were me, I'm so afraid I might say, well, I did what I said I'd do. I tried. I just get a couple drinks, and we all would be dead. But he made one. He saw named under the bottom Walter Tunk. That name amused him, so they'll call him Walter Tunk. And Walter Tunk said, "Funny you should call. Yes, I have a dear lady in our organization that telling me just her doctor is in the Oxford group, and he's a terrible drunkard. They can't help him. He just admitted it in last week's meeting. You stay in the parking. You stay in that booth, and I'll call you back." And he called the lady. Thank God the lady was home. And she answered the phone, and she said, "Why? You stay there, Reverend Tunk. I'll call the doctor's wife." And she called the doctor's wife. The doctor went, "Well, yes, the doctor would. He's drunk on the living room floor. He can't see anybody. But tomorrow we could talk to somebody." So the woman said, "Okay, we'll make arrangements to meet in my house." She was a very high-ranked society woman, heiress. She called Reverend Tunk back, got the guy's number downtown at the hotel, called him back, and thank God it went just like that, because he didn't have much time to wait to run that phone, I'll tell you. He was ready to go. He was ready to go. And then she told him how to take the bus out to her mansion the next day. And the next day, he went out there in the bus. He somehow stayed sober that night, thinking about it. And the doctor was brought out by his wife and two children. His son was a guy named Bob, too. They called him Young Bob, but he died a couple years ago at the age of 85. He was 16 then. He was a good friend of mine. And he always described going out there. His dad was so sick and hungover. And he kept saying to his wife, "You know, Ann, I'll talk to this guy, because I came home drunk and spoiled Mother's Day for you, but I don't want any more sermons about my drinking. Nobody seems to understand me at all. I'll give him 10 minutes. And the young man, Reb, they went out there. They chatted for a while, made some efforts at eating. And these two guys, the failed stockbroker and the drunken doctor, went into a room. And they stayed there for 4 hours. And they came out, and the doctor said, "My God, Ann, I don't know. I've never met anybody before who seemed to know how I feel and why I drink. I just can't believe it." And he said to Bill, "Bill, could you possibly, I know you want to get back to New York, but could you possibly stay with us a couple of weeks and we can do something about this?" And Bill thought, "Let's see, I really have not enough money to get out of town." "Yes, I can." A lot of things had happened just right, I'll tell you. So he moved in there, and they sat and discussed the spiritual values they had found in the Oxford group. Again and again, spiritual values and deep spiritual understandings. And after 2 weeks, the doctor said, "Bill, this weekend is the American Medical Association meeting in Atlantic City. I was there last year, and I was so drunk, and I was so embarrassed and humiliated. But I want to go back there this year and tell them what I found. You stay here with my wife and kids, and by God, I'm going to go show them what's going on." And off he went. And Monday morning, they got a call in the house about 7 in the morning. It was the doctor's nurse, officer. She said, I have some bad news for you, Mrs. Smith. I'm so sorry, but they called me from the station this morning at 6, and they had carried the doctor off the train so drunk he couldn't walk. And the station agent called me, and I went down to Gotham and got a cab driver, and he's laying on the floor of his office now. "And I'm so sorry. I know he tried so hard, but I guess you just can't do it." And she cried and got Bill, and they went down and got the doctor off the floor, brought him home and put him to bed. "And I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry." Drunks, you know. And they just did a very, very tough situation. And on Wednesday morning, he woke up. He said, "Oh, my God, I'm so sick. I'm so sick. What day is it?" Said, "Wednesday, Bob." "Oh, my God, I have to do a cancer operation. Look at my hand. I can't hold a knife. My God, they'll take away my license. What can I do?" And they got him up. Bill and his wife got him up, and they gave him a hot bath and then a cold bath and dressed him. And put him in his car, and he drove down to the hospital, and they said, "Hurry right home, Bob." And they went down to, should be home by 1. wasn't home at 1, wasn't home at 2, wasn't home at 3, wasn't home at 4. Everybody knew what happened to him. Drunk again. And suddenly the door burst open at 6 and he came in absolutely cold sober. He said, "Oh, what a great day I've had." He said, "Where the hell you been, Bob?" He said, "When I was doing that operation, I remember thinking about, in the Oxford group, they want you to make amends for your problems. And I thought a doctor shouldn't have to make amends. But I realized nothing to do with being a doctor. I've been all over town today making amends to everybody that I've hired." And he just felt wonderful. And they talked the next day and realized sitting around talking about spiritual values isn't what had kept Bill sober. It had been trying to help people. So they found the doctor had a friend, a nun up in the hospital, who said she had a real bad drunkard up there, and she would get him in there. So they went up, and tried to make arrangements to see him. They talked to his wife. They said, "We'd like to see him. We're sober, but maybe we can help him with his drinking." And she went in to see him. And he was a lawyer who'd moved from Kentucky to Ohio to get away from his drinking. Of course, it just got worse. And he said, "I'm not going to see anybody. I'm sick of lectures about my drinking. I'm just sick of lectures about my drinking." But she was a very strong woman. So the next day, they made arrangements for the two guys to come in and see him. And I heard him talk 40 years ago. He said, "I was laying in that bed in Akron, Ohio. My wife insisted I see these men. I didn't have any desire in what they had to say about my drinking. But they never talked about my drinking once. They talked about their drinking and how they felt. And I never heard anybody describe me like that. I couldn't believe it. I was so impressed. I stuck with them fellas, and I've been with them ever since." He became number 3. And very quickly, they tried to help some drunks around town. And very bad luck, because they'd take them to the Oxford group meeting, and unless they responded to the religion, they wouldn't stay sober. And just one more little thing in passing. They finally got a young guy in. Young guy, 29, a guy named Ernie. And he came in, and they wasn't sure if he was old enough to be an alcoholic yet, but they put him through the paces. And he fell in love with the doctor's daughter and brought us our first relationship. I don't know a word that sends a cold chill down any sponsor's spine worse than that. "I want to talk to you about my new relationship." What you really need is to have a little thing on your phone that says, "Uh-huh," and put the phone on that and then go about your day. And they got married. And it sounds wonderful. That happened in my family. My youngest daughter married a guy I sponsored. Nobody asked my opinion of it. But I went to the wedding, and I walked my daughter down the aisle. And I'll tell you, I want to give you a classic example of mixed emotions. Watching your daughter marry a man whose fifth step you've heard. Yeah. You can't really say anything, but you can give hints. "Let me know if he ever brings a sheep home, honey." And they realize he's a newlywed. He shouldn't be running around with these guys to all these Oxford group meetings anymore. He should stay home and take care of his wife. So they had him do that. They felt sad when he got drunk and died and turned her against AA for the next 50 years. But little by little, it grew. Pretty soon, Bill went back to New York, started a little group there. And little by little. And in 1938, they tried to get some money from the Rockefellers, and they wouldn't give it to him. He said, "You spoil your organization." And in 1939, they continued to work along. And they wrote a book. They're going to write a book that's going to give them enough money to build hospitals for drunkards all over America. And they wrote this book and didn't sell any copies. So they didn't have any hospitals, which was a lucky thing for us. If we'd gone the hospital route, we wouldn't be here either. In fact, that's kind of an interesting thing. That book, it's under some attack every so often in Alcoholics Anonymous because it seems so old-fashioned in its writing. And I understand that. When I first came to AA, my first meetings in 1949, I was 22 years old, and they gave me a copy of the book to read. And I read it, and I was on my way to becoming a successful writer. And I read this book. They don't say it's a badly written book. It isn't a badly written book. I just found it to be terminally dull. Just dull, dull. Oh, Jesus. Some years later, when I came off Skid Row, and my new sponsor gave me the book to read again. And this time I read it, and I realized I'd been mistaken before. It was even duller than I remembered. I wrote impressive things for radio and television. Take, do this action, buy this product, blah, 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 and I'm just great. And you read this book, you're waiting for some exhilaration, and you... If you are thorough at this stage of your development... So I had to give up on that book. I remember hearing people say, oh, our book is a miracle. Oh, man. That's one of the words that's usually misused in AA. Everything's a miracle. Miracles are supposed to be something rare and unexplainable. Heard a guy a few years ago say, I got up very early this morning, and I looked at the eastern sky, and the sun was coming up, and I said, it's a miracle. I've been given another day of wonderful sobriety. Oh, Jesus. Get up early tomorrow and have another one, you goof. You know. Miracles are supposed to be unexplainable. And that's one of the things about this book, you know. This guy was 3 years sober and surrounded by much more failure than success. Most people didn't stay sober. And he sat down and wrote a book without any background of psychology or abnormal psychology or medicine or even much of successful retreat recovery. And he wrote this book, and you know, new people sometimes say, 3 years sober. Oh, I bet he knew enough to write a book by then. You'll discover when you're 3 years sober, you don't know enough to write a book. When you're 5 years sober, you just try to be nice to people 3 years sober. Keep coming back, Jimmy. By the time you're 10 years sober, you hate to send people 3 years sober to get your coffee. Was that two creams and one sugar, or two sugars and one cream? Never mind, I'll get it. By the time you're 20 years sober, you hate to have people 3 years sober unattended on your property. Yeah. But here this guy, 3 years sober, wrote this book, didn't sell. But the miraculous thing about it is that it has changed more alcoholic lives since 1939 than all other therapies combined in the history of mankind. That's what's called a miracle. People sometimes complain about its writings, because it seems to be written in archaic language of 1930s, but it's not in there. It's not written as an example of prose. What it is, really, and it's hard, it takes a long time to realize this, It's almost like a cookbook. It's a series of recipes. It isn't, you can master the book and memorize it and be drunk next week. It's just like memorizing a cookbook. I know every one of these, and I'm starving to death. You got to do the damn things. And that's why we have sponsors, as Tom so very well talked about tonight. And his life and my life saved my life. But they wrote this book and didn't do very well. And then by 1940, they were doing fairly well. And the Saturday Evening Post had a writer who specialized in corruption. He'd just written a series on the corrupt Philadelphia labor unions on the docks. In his next assignment, worm your way into this Alcoholics Anonymous crap and give us the dirt on it. And he wormed his way in, and went, my God, it's what they said it was. They're just like, nobody's making any money, nobody's doing anything. It's just, and he wrote this glowing article in the New York, in the Saturday Evening Post in March 1941. In fact, in our literature, you can find the copy of that article. And it took the nation by storm, because nobody had ever heard of anything that they could do for their drunken husband or drunken wife or drunken friends. Nothing has ever worked, and here's something working. And they just flooded New York with letters, and AA groups picked up everywhere. My God, in little towns and cities and states and AA everywhere. Bill would try to send them information, send them the book, and tell them, give them a little idea how you could run a meeting and what they should do. And in 1940, by the end of 1941, AA was planted in a lot of places. By 1942, it was just growing. And then Bill Wilson noticed something funny. The groups were starting to die out again. By 1943, our group is, I don't know if it's the war or what, but our groups are dying, and nobody wants to come to meetings anymore because we're fighting all the time, and we're getting in beefs all the time. And by 1944, Bill, I got to unify A somehow. And he started the Grapevine, which at that time was the size of a tabloid. Now it's just a small little magazine, which many of us subscribe to, and I hope you do too. But he started the Grapevine, but that didn't seem to help much. In 1945, you're sitting there, three more letters that day from three more groups that are, please take us off your list. None of us are sober anymore. And he realized AA was going to go down. And a doctor in North Carolina sent an article into the Grapevine and said, Bill, I don't know if you know about this, but it seems to be kind of like us. And Bill read this article. It was about six guys in Baltimore. One had just got out of jail again, and he told his friends about how that chaplain down there says he understands me. He doesn't understand me. Just you guys do, and we can't, none of us. They said, we all got to stop drinking. We're dying. Maybe we can help each other stop drinking. One of us feels like drinking, the other five will talk to him. So they said, let's try it. And they wrote a little plan, what they're going to do, and they elected officers, five officers and one member. Who do you identify with, Bunky? And they called themselves after George Washington. Called themselves the Washingtonians. And everybody just laughed at them. You boobs, you can't keep sober yourself. You're going to help each other. That's really funny. But they stayed sober somehow. And some people from Philadelphia heard about it and came down and went back, started a little group in their place. And some people came down from Boston and became one of the more successful places in the Washington and New York and Washington. And at the end of a year, they had a number of little chapters, and they were all staying sober. Nobody could understand why. And the second year, they really took off, because entertainment in those days was public speaking. And, you know, there's no television or much of anything. But you'd get a famous speaker would come to town, everybody, and go into a big auditorium. And they got a couple of these speakers in the Washingtonian movements. And so they really gave it all. They just, by hundreds, they converted people. Near the end of the second year, they had chosen Washington's birthday as their anniversary. They said, you know, a lot of people don't know what we're doing. They still think we're crazy. Get somebody from your community who is a kind of well-known decision maker. We don't have big shots, but people are on the way up. And so all over the country on February 22nd, 1842, in Springfield, Illinois, they had a young lawyer named Abraham Lincoln came in. If you ever read a book of Lincoln's speeches, you read Lincoln's speech to the Washingtonians. And he didn't know much about it. Much of it was just boilerplate. But he said, you know, I know all you men, and I work with you men, and I respect you. But I've never been able to understand your thirst. It is such a deadly thing. But now you've lost your thirst. I am so proud to be here. And it continued to grow. By 1845... it had a membership of about 100,000 sober drunkards, which may not impress you, but AA after 5 years didn't have 1,000. And the AA leaders of the Washingtonians got together in 1845, and they came up with the thought that many people in AA have today. Maybe we're wasting our time just working with drunkards. Maybe we should work with people with all sorts of problems. Narcotics addicts who are not drunkards, but have problems of opium and laudanum. People, maybe we could stamp out the sale of alcohol. That'd get rid of alcohol all at once. Maybe we should work on the anti-slavery movement. Maybe we should get Texas in the Union. All sorts of things. And these 100,000 people went out there and gave it all they got. And they really wanted to change the world. And by 1848, the Washingtons were extinct and all of them died drunk. Nearly all of them. I had a book home written in 1861 by one of the few survivors. He said, I don't know what happened. We were doing so well, but after a while, we all got so wrapped up in things, we didn't have time to talk to drunkards anymore. And they all went down. And they were so extinct, Bill Wilson had never heard of them. Nobody had ever heard of the only successful treatment for alcoholics in history. And he'd never heard of them. So as he looked at his letters and read what happened to the Washingtonians, in a last gasp effort to save Alcoholics Anonymous, he sat down and wrote the 12 traditions long after the book came out, long after thousands of people had died drunk. And he issued them one by one in the long form. If you don't know what the long form is, in the back of the book against the short form, there's a long form which really spells them out. In my group in Los Angeles, we read the long form once a month at least. And he issued them one by one. And unfortunately, Alcoholics Anonymous at that time had a great problem, which we have today. We don't know what way to solve it. It's full of alcoholics. So most people, we don't want your damn rules. We're here to find love, goddammit. And he issued them one by one. He and Lois rode around his motorcycle, come down to New Jersey, go up to the Hamptons, wherever there's meetings, and explain. These are not rules. These are efforts to keep A alive. And they decided if we could only get all these people together, somebody from Los Angeles and somebody from Houston and Dallas and Chicago, and because people were fighting and arguing and having all sorts of things. So they decided to have a little one meeting, just one meeting, in Cleveland in 1950. And in 1950, they had a big meeting there, and I got the pictures from the back, and I got the tapes of that meeting, very interesting, where they're going to try to convince the people that the traditions were viable. And they still were not, they wanted public approval, so they got mostly non-alcoholic speakers, the warden of San Quentin and the warden of Sing Sing and social events. And among other things, Bill and Dr. Bob talked. And Dr. Bob was dying of cancer. They said, you probably don't want to talk, Bob. He said, well, I've got to talk. I'm 15 years sober. That's the second longest sobriety in the world. So on that day, his son on one side and an old guy on the other side took him to the podium, tall, gaunt, dying man. And he said, I want to welcome you all to Cleveland. I hope that you'll go back and tell the boys and girls in your group that we're all trying to do the right thing and we're trying to find our way. He said, I look over this crowd. I'm glad that some small thing I did years ago helped bring this about. And I want to apologize for my health. I've been in bed most of the past few months. I don't know what's going to happen to me. Just usual stuff that you expect to hear. But then, because he said, I want to call your attention to two or three things which I think are important. And in the next 2 minutes, he gave what many people conceive to be the Gettysburg Address of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because he was a great transmitter of the message, better than Bill. And he was dying. It's almost like a dying declaration. He said, first, let us remember to keep our program simple. Let's not louse it all up with Freudian complexes, which may be of interest to the scientific mind, but has nothing to do with our work here. Our work here, when reduced to the last, consists of love and service. And we all know what love is, and we all know what service is. And secondly, he said, let us guard that erring member, the tongue, and try to use it with kindness and understanding. And there isn't a person in this room or any room like it in the world who doesn't know exactly what he means. Because we're all very nice when things are going our way. Hey, it works just wonderful. I love everyone. But let somebody hurt our feelings. Or disagree with us at a group level in honor. And we give them the worst insult of all. It's the funny, isn't this funny? Most of us have spent our lives, early lives, avoiding the term alcoholic. But I'm not an alcoholic, till we have to admit we are. But then after you're sober a while, you want to really put somebody down, you say, I don't even think he's alcoholic. And finally he said, let us never reach that stage of smug complacency. He said, none of us would be here today if someone hadn't taken the time to explain things to us, take us to a few meetings, give us a pat on the back when we need it so desperately. Let us never reach that stage of smug complacency when we are too busy to carry this message to our brothers who still suffer from the terrible disease of alcoholism. And he sat down and was dead shortly thereafter. But also the tape, six young guys, each took two traditions and introduced them. And I don't know who they were, but I don't know what they looked like, but just like you could hear their tail wagging. Just yeah. And here's what I thought. And they read them and described them and they said, you know, the important thing people know today, you know, we have no way to enforce these traditions. These aren't rules. You can break every one of them still. We can't keep you out of a meeting. There's no A police. That's one of the things that many of us think may have been a mistake. In my home group, however unfairly it really is, I have a reputation of being a dictator-type sponsor, of ordering people what to do. And they forget, you cannot be a dictator-type sponsor without the absolute approval of the dictatee. In AA. All they have to say is, screw you! And the dictatorship is over. It would be nice if we had people who came at night and said, did you say screw you to your sponsor? Come with us to the camp for a little training. But anyway, they introduced him. And here's a funny little thing, just a funny little side. It means nothing. But Bill Wilson, after all that, obviously was not quite sure he could win the election, that they'd be accepted. And he wound up the readings by saying, we have now heard the 12 traditions read, and you understand them. Seeing no objections, they're accepted. Thank God, because they saved our life. And little by little, AA continued to grow. Now it's 134 countries. And it's very interesting. And because it deals with alcoholics of our type, which never been treatable, because I've been sober a long time, and I've been active all these years, I've been invited to come and speak in some exotic places like South Africa and Spain and France and Germany and England and Ireland and all the Scandinavian countries. Last year I was in Bali and Indonesia and in Central America. A lot of places, all the states, all the... You'd really think you'd find exotic AA in these places, but you don't. Except for the accents. You hear the same emotions you hear in the home group in New Jersey. Well, I'm not so sure. I'm not sure if I'm an alcoholic. Somebody else is smoothing them. Here's what you should do. You know, it just brings tears to your eyes all over the world. They don't even have to understand the language you're talking. You just hear what they're saying. Those who suffer and those who try to assuage the suffering. And so this Alcoholics Anonymous has really become a great, great thing. And every time a group such as this group has an anniversary and it continues to grow and flourish, it indicates that the message of Alcoholics Anonymous is being disseminated, because there are still many groups in America where you can go and sit in there, they never discuss the steps, they never discuss the book, they never discuss anything, and one by one they get drunk, and they get somebody else new to come, and they sit around, they get drunk, and they warn them against activist groups like this group. Really true. In my home group, Pacific Group of Los Angeles, people are warned all the time against that. But because we've stayed sober and done the things, now it's the largest group in the world, 1,000 people, every Wednesday night. Some of you have been there, some of you are members. And that's what we have to do, is remember that the message of Alcoholics Anonymous is really quite simple. Is to, as the traditions say, just a couple things I want to talk about the traditions, just in passing, because I think we get problems sometimes. There's a lot of talking about some meetings today about do you still have to be an alcoholic to be an AA? I mean, my God, maybe that was true in 1935, but now so many young people are on narcotics and everything, we should be taking care of them. And we have people come to AA and say, well, I'm not an alcoholic, but in the third tradition says the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. I have a desire to stop drinking, so I can come anytime I want to. And I can vote and do whatever I want to. It's hard to overcome that till you read the long form of the tradition from which it was abbreviated. It says we want to treat all those who suffer from alcoholism. When they abbreviated it, they had no idea that someday non-alcoholics would try to sneak into AA. I mean, my God, you can't get alcoholics to come. Why would non-alcoholics want to come? And that's what you got to remember, that the message here is just exactly what Tom talked about tonight, and I'll talk about for about 2 minutes before I sit down, and that is carrying the message of identification. That is what makes AA effective. Why is that necessary? Everyone in this room knows how it feels to know that my case is different. And you have that when you come, and you have, sometimes it enhances it after going to a few meetings. And nobody's ever been able to get through that wall. Because no matter what you say to them, here's what I think you ought to do. People like us, just, I'm sure for the last 4,000 years, we're like magnets for meaningless advice. You know, here's what I think you ought to do. Why don't you try this? Anyway, passersby, think you ought to go to rehab. On. And it's meaningless because the defense is up. Somehow there's got to be a way to get through that wall. And what it turns out to be is identification. Most of us have felt the first flush of hearing somebody talk about something. I thought, my God, I thought I was the only one that felt that way. My God, that's why I drink. I don't drink because I love alcohol. I drink because it gives me some peace for my damn head. And on and on. And this light opening. And that is why, you stop and think about it, there's only been two movements in the history of the world where alcoholics of our type stayed sober. And they were both the only two movements that consisted of drunkard talking to drunkard to get through that wall. The Washingtonians, which got away from it and expired, and A, why we're here. Because identification is the way through that wall. That is why members of Alcoholics Anonymous, who had a gambling problem also, a good friend of mine, Jim Willis in Los Angeles, he brought gamblers to AA, and they, I don't understand these old drunken fools. So he wrote to New York and became the first person to get the permission to use the steps and change the word alcohol to gambling and formed Gamblers Anonymous, which to this day is still the most famous of all, the most successful. And it's all over. You go to a GA meeting, big pictures of Jim Willis on the wall. Just like we have Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob. And then some guys in North Hollywood that I knew were trying to help narcotics addicts. I don't want anything to sit with them choosers. So they got permission to use the 12 steps and founded Narcotics Anonymous. Then some guys in the west side of town where I live formed Cocaine Anonymous. And then some ladies down around Hollywood formed Overeaters Anonymous. And those are the big four. And, you know, and they are designed for people who have that problem. And the people who designed them are people who had, it was alcoholic and the and doesn't work. And I never really understood it completely until I was about 2 years sober. I was 2 years sober. I wasn't doing terribly well. I still had no front teeth. But I had a job. I learned to go to work holding my lip like this. But I was giving a talk one night in the club, on obsessions. I'm an authority on obsessions. Not the recovery from them, just the obsessions. And some woman came after the meeting, she kind of pudgy woman, she says, "Oh, that's wonderful. I never heard anybody talk about obsessions." And we have a little group called Overeaters Anonymous over on Olympic Boulevard. "Could you come and speak at our group Sunday?" "Sure." I weighed 129 pounds. I looked like a rail. I'll give the girl something to shoot at. So I went in this room, and our Christ the King of something church, and there are the seven or eight rather plump ladies sitting around the table looking woebegone. And I gave them a great talk on their obsessions and how they'd affected me and how I was goofy. And I sat down there. And then they had a little sharing session, and I couldn't believe what I was hearing. Woman over here, she had a 10-year-old son in the military school in Long Beach. He said, just had his birthday. She sent her husband down to get him. She took out the special cake she had gotten for the affair, took a little bite to make sure it was good, had another little bite, finished the whole cake before they got back. And she was just so guilt-ridden and sick about it. And I didn't say anything because I'm too nice a guy. But I thought to myself, Jesus, just have a piece of cake and forget it. What's wrong with you? Over here, a lady talking about eating ice cream. She's had an obsession for you. "Oh, my husband gets so mad at me, but I have to have that. I love my ice cream. And I just wonder." And I didn't say anything because I'm too nice. I thought, Jesus, no wonder you're fat, for Christ's sake. My favorite was over here, though, a woman who talked about eating till she couldn't eat anymore, put her finger down her throat, vomited up some food, and started eating again. And I didn't say anything because I'm a nice guy. But I thought to myself, don't bother shaking hands with me after the meeting. I can see doing that for drinking, but not eating. I've done it for drinking a lot.
God, late, sir. Sun's still up. I could go back around tonight.
Now, what was different? I understood it. I have a good brain. I understood it perfectly. I didn't identify. It was just strange behavior. And that's the way it is with all of these things. And that's why people like us sometimes get so disappointed, because we can't make our folks understand our alcoholism. And you never will, because they don't understand. That's why they say, in all good faith, "Couldn't you have a little wine at Christmas? Couldn't you?" You know, they say, "How could you say such a thing to me?" They don't know. They don't know. It's like me talking to those women, "Why don't you just eat a piece of cake?" They don't know. But this is a very, very obsessive disease. Now, Jim Willis, the original founder of Gamblers Anonymous, got so busy in the mid-1960s, he was setting up GA all over. Didn't even have time for A anymore. So everybody felt sad and he got drunk and died. But as they say in GA, he never gambled again. That's the name of that. And it turns out that all of this success is based on what Tom talked about, and you'll hear again and again, the 12 steps. There are a series of things to do that what? Make you better? Who knows? Make you wonderful? No. What they do is they change your perception of the world. The same things look different. It seems impossible, but it does. You know, one of the things that helped me discover I was an alcoholic, because this time I had a guy who really worked on me. And I told him, "I'm not really an alcoholic. My problem really isn't alcohol. I wish it were, but my problem is there's something wrong inside of me." And they say, alcoholics can't stop drinking. I can stop. I've stopped drinking all the time. My problem is, after I stop, the next day or a couple of days or 3 days later, somebody seems to sneak into my bedroom and put an invisible spring in my gut. And the next day, they start to tighten it. And it doesn't come out as, "I need a drink." It comes out as a little growing restlessness, a little irritability, a little tired of listening to the sermon what I did last week. Get off it! Little by little, just watching whatever technicolor there is in the world around me slowly return to the black and gray and white that it always is. And I've spent thousands and thousands of dollars with psychiatrists to find a way to beat those emotions. and I've read books, and I've joined groups. But I'm telling you how you beat that feeling. You have a couple drinks. They say, this is my problem. It isn't. It is, I guess, when I'm drunk. But they don't understand my problem. My problem is not alcohol. And I always took that vow. And it took my sponsor finally, once he had won my identification with him, he explained to me. I explained to him. I heard him say one night at a meeting, and I had already told him I wasn't an alcoholic, so it doesn't bother me, but he said to somebody, he said, as long as you think your problem is alcohol, you're going to die drunk. And on the way home, I said, Jesus, Bob, why do you say things like that? You make me look bad. Of course these people, their problem is alcohol. That's why they're here. He said, nah, if their problem is alcohol, they shouldn't even be in AA. They're wasting up time. I said, oh, come on, Bob. Light's a little hot on the set where you're playing today. What the hell going on? And he gave me a long harangue over a period of days, most of which I was able to blot out. But some of us got through and it began to change my perception. It took a while, but it did it. He said, kid, look. If your problem is alcohol, and a lot of people come here thinking their problem is maybe isn't alcohol. If your problem is alcohol, you don't need AA. What you do is you quit drinking, and you clean up your act, and you're home free. That doesn't work, Bob. For God's sakes, I've tried that 500 times. He said, that's right. That's because your problem isn't alcohol, kid. Your problem is something that sounds like alcohol, but it isn't. What could it be, Bob? He said, something called alcoholism. I said, oh, Jesus, Bob. Don't play word games with me. I look terrible, but I'm a very smart man. I said, alcohol, alcoholism. Hooray, I'm cured. I'm cured. Shut up, he explained. He said, now get this in your head, kid. The difference is this. In this thing called alcoholism, this, which unfortunately for you and me looks almost exactly the same as an alcohol problem with the naked eye. This mind-consuming, perception-distorting, bodily-eroding thing called alcoholism. You'll discover sooner or later that stopping drinking and cleaning up your act has no significant long-term effect on your life other than to gradually make it so painful you can't stand it. I said, Jesus, Bob, I never heard anybody say that. I said, getting sober makes it better. He said, nah. Not for people like us, it makes it worse. I said, then why do these people drink it when they're so bad for them? He said, they're not drinking it because they're so bad for them. You don't seem to know much for a guy who's been in and out of AA for 10 years. He said, you know what an alcoholic is? It's a person who gets an unnatural reaction to alcohol. Yes, I know that. It sets up a phenomenon of craving. Then you have to have more and more and drink till you go mad. He said, nah, that's podium talk. Don't you understand why people drink, people like us drink alcohol? And he had a Coke in his hand. I'll tell you, just think of this as a drink, kid. When I have a couple drinks, it almost instantly alters my perception of reality. It almost instantly changes my relationship to the world around me. It almost instantly makes me taller and more self-contained and them less frightening. I said, Jesus, Bob, what's wrong with that? He said, because it is not really happening, you moron. I said, okay, I understand that because it does that for me too. He said, what makes an alcoholic? Alcohol is to do something to you. Unless it's doing something special for you, it'll do nothing to you. Because you'll stop. But if it's doing something special for you, you'll require it. I said, well, now they know that alcohol is bad. Why are they drinking now? He said, that's the other part of it, kid. And he had a philosophy that I was found to be intermittently interesting to me. He said, when people are born and raised, it's tough being a kid. You have to learn a lot. You have to learn what you have to give and what you have to get. You got to take a little crap here and there. And you have problems you got to find a solution for, no matter how long it takes. And you have to find conflicts that you have a way around. And you discover that some days are just crappy, and you got to get through them. And it's all, that whole process is called maturing. But if you become a mature individual, you can really live comfortably. You can hold a job as long as you want to, get along with your co-employees, get along with your mate if you have one, have a nice relationship with your kids, get along with the neighbors, enjoy square vacations. He said, but this almost never happens to alcoholics. Said, why not, Bob? He said, we've discovered along the way that when we have problems we cannot find an easy solution for, we can drink them away. Here's to you, household finance. Here's to you, bitch. I never liked you anyway. Hey, Mr. Carlson, take your job and shove it up your nose. And it really works. But there's one little thing I never notice. All of these things get stuffed into a little caboose in my psyche somewhere. And they don't get solved. A series of unsolved childish emotions. We call them alcoholic emotions because it's a little more nice to say it. As well as alcoholic, but they're childish. He said, and people like us, sooner or later, are always going to straighten out. We're going to get going. We're going to come home from work. We're not going to be drunk all the time. We're just going to be good people. It's going to be wonderful. I won't drink anymore. And never once realize it is impossible for alcoholics of our type. Because sooner or later, someone will trigger those emotions. Someone will hurt our feelings. Someone will say something bad about me. Something will begin to fulminate against me, and that starts the fission. And when I was young, I didn't mind it very much. But a guy would do that, I'd just go punch him in the face and quit the job. But when you got kids and a wife, you can't do that anymore. You got to take it. And you just try to, how could I get the evil of that guy? And as the time goes by little, you see his friends are probably all against you too. And little by little, and they're all trying to get you. And you get so you lie awake at night thinking about these people and what they're doing to you. And it gets awfully bad. Scientists who study alcoholics say that people of our type can get to a point where we must drink to preserve our sanity. And pretty soon that ignites the light. And pretty soon I'm gone. They say, why did you leave your job, Clancy? You had to get a good job. Oh, they're a bunch of crappers. I didn't like them anyway. And I don't remember why. I just remember that it was a bad thing. He said, that's why people like us always drink again. Because it's necessary. At first, it's because we want to. But as the years go by, it becomes necessary. I said, Jesus, Bob. That's the story of my life for the last 10 years. I've had some big jobs. I've been in some big places. I've made a lot of money. And sooner or later, somebody would screw me around. Or my emotions would get upset. Or people, unfairness. Sometimes I'd get drunk and wouldn't get back to work. And sometimes I just quit. I thought, I've got enough talent. I could get a job. And he said, there's a name for people like you, kid. I thought, what could that be? He said, you're an alcoholic. I said, my God, if that's what an alcoholic is, that's what I am. It has nothing to do with how where you are, how many times you've been in jail or nut houses. Although I've been in jail and nut houses, but that has nothing to do with it. The purpose of the problem of an alcoholic is sobriety is untenable, and now drinking is untenable, and there's no place to go. I said, my God. And that was December of 1958, a long time ago. I was on the edge of death, I guess. And my life didn't get suddenly better, but at least I didn't think I was insane anymore. I believe what he said. And little by little, as he told me, what happened is that I didn't suddenly become wildly converted, but I began to listen to people in a different way. People talk about alcoholism to see what it fit to that theory. And little by little, I began to realize that, my God, that's what it is. And I stayed sober. And as a result of that, I did what my sponsor said little by little. and I began to feel, I'll tell you, the greatest, I'm going to be done soon, but the greatest thing I would wish to any new people or disturbed people in this room, I began to think that this man knew how I felt. And that doesn't seem like much, but I had never known anybody that I believed knew how I felt. They all said they did. My dad, my doctor, was minister. We know how you feel. You have to say, gee, thanks. But you want to say, no, you don't, damn it. And what's important about finding somebody that knows how you feel? Because, well, as I said, we all get a lot of advice. But if you can find somebody that you believe knows how you feel, that becomes meaningful information, goes right through that door, which is the thing we're all seeking here. I remember shortly after that, I was at the Brentwood meeting, just about 7 blocks from where O.J. Simpson didn't kill his wife later. I was standing there, and I wasn't doing very well, old clothes and no teeth. And my sponsor said, see that woman over there? Yes, I see that bag. He said, I want you to apologize to her. Why should I? Someone told me that at the club Monday night, you called her a bitch. She is a bitch. Why do you think she's a bitch? She told her new girl to stay away from me. Well, she's right. You apologize. I can't think of a person in the world who would have told me that I wouldn't have said, to hell with you. I'm not going to apologize to that old puss bag. She's been against me ever since I got sober. She says bad things about me. She's a mean, nasty thing. I apologize. She spit all over me. I made that Clancy knuckle under. I wouldn't give her this satisfaction. But somebody that I believed knew how I felt, I found myself going, I'm sorry I called you a bitch. You bitch. He got me to not quit a job, stuffing envelopes that I thought was way beneath me. He got me to go to a meeting where they treated me badly. Little by little, I took actions I never took before. I knew all about AA. I knew as much about AA the day I got sober as I do now. But I had never done it. I just knew it, which means nothing. I memorized the cookbook. And little by little, I got a job, another job. But finally held a job 4 months, my second year of sobriety. And after my second birthday, I got a job in a medical corporation as a beginning writer. And they took me down to the thrift shop, St. John's Thrift Shop in Santa Monica, got me a couple suits. Didn't quite fit, but they were close, so I held one shoulder up like that. And a couple sport coats and some shirts. I thought, I'm going to make my move here. I'm going to really do it. I still had no front teeth, but I could. And I went to work there, and I really decided to make my move. And I was there about 5 days. And I heard a guy say, that guy hasn't got any front teeth. And this starts. Why would he say something like that? I'm trying so hard. I might as well just poke him and quit the job. There's no sense. No matter what happens, I can't. I thought, but if I do that, I'll have to explain it to that damn Bob. So I called him up. Bob, this guy doesn't come out of here. He said, I understand. Here's what you do. You go talk to him. You can't talk to this guy. He's a wrongo. He gave me some way to do it. That doesn't work, Bob. Ridiculous. But I went over to this guy and I said, you know, why did you find it necessary to ridicule me because I had every front teeth? I really can't do anything about it at the moment. I don't want to have. I want to have front teeth. I'm trying hard. He said, oh, I didn't ridicule you at all. I was talking to someone about you must have had a very tough thing happened in your life to be like that, and you're trying to make a comeback, and you're working very hard, and we're all very proud of you. I think that's remarkable. And I said, oh. There must have been 10 times in that first year I was ready to go, and I'd call Bob to give me some goofy thing to do. But by the time I was 5 years sober, I was director of advertising for that big medical corporation. Had front teeth. If any of you are new, lost front teeth, let me give you hope. Once you become spiritually pure, they grow back. I don't remember exactly how that went, you know. When I was 7 years sober, I was downtown doing public relations. I mean, I was called into Hollywood. You remember this, Marlene, for Boss Radio, became the number one hard rock station in the world. We all wore shiny suits, and we said things like, "What's coming on down, baby?" When I was 10 years sober, I was downtown doing marketing. 15 years sober, I was a marketing director in Beverly Hills. When I was 5 years sober, the same wife and children who had left me years ago heard the crinkle of green in my wallet, rushed to my side. It's true. It sounds like I went like this. I went like this. Oh, Jesus. But I got there. Now, isn't that a nice story? From nothing to something, all with the aid of 12 simple steps in the AA program and trying to sponsor people. But the point I'm trying to make is this. Perhaps, you know, what alcohol, if you're new, what is AA, what are we here for? As I said, do you get drier and drier? I hope not. God, I've been sober so long, I'll burst into flame up here. The purpose of AA, I believe this implicitly, and I hope you remember this, is to very slowly do what alcohol did fast. To change my perception of reality, to make the same things look different, to change my relationship to the world around me, to little by little away take that fear and terrible terror and not be afraid so much anymore, to live in the world. Now, nobody ever gets that all the time, but it comes for longer periods as you go along. You can be as comfortable at 2 months as you'll be at 50 years, but just not very long. Just, it's like reading Shakespeare by lightning flash. Yeah. But then it's happened to me a lot of times. The only problem is it changes your thinking somehow. And when I was 15 years sober, I was doing very well. My kids were doing well. I was very well. And then got one of these terrible feelings and some hideous fit of misjudgment. I left that job in Beverly Hills. And for the last 34 years, I've been the managing director of the Skid Row Mission that threw me out in 1958. And people say, "Why would you give up your great career to run that damn Skid Row Mission?" And there's no good answer to that. Well, it was such a significant decrease in salary, I couldn't pass it up. Well, I'm still looking for those two bastards that threw me out. Once I get them, I'll be out of it. And my kids all grew up. Three of my daughters turned 18 last year in AA. And only one of my daughters has turned out badly. She's become a judge. She came home at Christmas a few years ago and said, "Dad, remember when we were little girls used to get so upset and send us to our room?" I said, "Sure, honey." She said, "When you come to Albuquerque, I'm going to send you to a little room." I have no need to go to Albuquerque. But Wednesday morning, I'll do something. I got to stay here to be in New York at the Atlantic Group Tuesday night. But Wednesday morning, I'll do something. I'll be back. I'll leave my house up in West Los Angeles, big yard out by the ocean, get in that freeway, go downtown, park in this dreadful, dismal, lethal part of town underneath our building. And I'll walk around the building and step over the bodies of men, women, and children dying from alcoholism and drug addiction and abandonment and insanity. And I'll go in and we'll spend the day trying to figure out some way to get these poor bastards to admit their problem or be willing to take some action that they will not take that's essential for their life. Then I'll go home at night and have dinner, go to a meeting, sleep like a top. Because it turns out something. It's hard to understand exactly. If you're new tonight, I want to tell you something. You probably don't know you've got this yet. You got something here that had never been available in the 4,000 years. Just stop and think for a moment, just quickly. You and I, all of us, are so fortunate. Through no merit of our own, through nothing we've done or deserved, we've been born into the only window of help for people like us in the history of mankind. And the biggest problem we have is not to take it for granted. But the goal, the thing we find here, we find a lot of things. We find jobs, and we can find comfort. We can find friends. We can find a lot of things. But the greatest gift is one that we don't even know about sometimes. The gift that you have and I have of one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic to help him reduce his feelings of difference at least enough so that he will begin to take actions he does not yet believe in. And when that moment comes, the miracle begins. Happy anniversary.
The sponsorship group would like to thank you for coming out tonight, and we hope we brought you a typical AA meeting, and we have a nice way of closing. Clancy will take us out with the Lord's Prayer.
Hallelujah.